So let's just say this is the beginning. Welcome to EP2. And this is So You Think You're Going to Grow, huh? So basically, connecting from last week into this week, we're talking about the terms you should know. You should know what topping is. You should know what transplanting is. You should know what a taproot is. You should know you should know what topping, LST, fimming, scrogging. You should get familiar with these terms, because if you do, it's going to be a lot easier for you when you're doing them in real time to know what they look like. And don't just look up one video. Maybe look up three or four videos and get a general consensus of what these people are doing. What Matt was expressing before, and I wanted to add to, but nobody heard, was imagine you have a trident, right? So you have the three parts of the plant growing. This is your main here, right? And on your main, you also have another small trident, right? So these are the three that are growing. I can't line them up. There you go. So these are the three that are growing. These two on the outside here on the bottom, these two are going straight out. These are your branches that you already have. And as your main comes up, you have another one. So if you were to cut this here, and this is gone, I don't know where my camera is because everything's new in my office, you're going to be left with two tops. And that's because you're taking the first top, which is actually up there, with two tops away. You could take this one away, leaving yourself with two up top. But most people do a hard top, which is they cut this whole thing off, leaving it with the two pretty much developed tops already. I don't know if that helps anybody. If you're a grower, that might be already something you understand. But if you're a beginner and you get into the minimal amount of topping you have to do, which would be like a non-invasive top, you get in there and it's just going to be like this Italian hands. And you want to spread that stuff apart and just cut the middle off. And when you take the middle away, it's like, hey, I'm a growing here. How you doing? So when you want to take that.
I'm just thinking of somebody writing this down. Be like, tridents, Italian
tridents,
hands.
Tridents of Italian hands. Crazy. And it's what it looks like. So no, when you get in there, just make sure you don't. Because that's the thing. You could take that whole top off and it's really not a problem. But it does take longer for your plant to come back. If you take just that little tippy top of the budling off, it's not fimming. Fimming is instead of taking that whole amount of growth off and cutting it here, you cut it in the middle. Cutting it in the middle could produce multiple tops because you're going to slow it down and the other tops are still not cut. So.
And if you do that multiple times, then this one becomes two, and this one over here becomes two, and then you can top those, and those two will be, you're just multiplying as you're growing up.
So when you top a plant,
I'd be a great sign language person.
So when you top a plant, right, you're going to have that node now split into two main tops, and they're going to come up. And when they come up, you're going to wait until they get three nodes on them again, and you're going to top it again. So now you have four main tops. And if you keep this going and you spread out the canopy, which Matt was talking about before, having an even canopy, when you do get to flip your plant, you're going to have even canopy, which equals even PPFD distribution. So you're going to be able to use your bar light and really get a good, photon array on your canopy without really wasting anything. And this exactly, you got Max Blend saying scrogging, sea green, monster cropping's a little the other way. That's something we're not even going to get into right now, but super cropping, on the other hand, that is more of a high stress train. And if your plant is just going nuts and you have this abundant growth in one of your tops that just will not stop topping, you could just bend this thing over, which would be the sense of rolling the stem in your fingertips until it's malleable, and just fold it down, little Italian hands, right? So
Baby Italians.
So you roll this around and you get this to drop, and you could put it underneath your scrog, you know. Ted Farmer says, sure, spread it outward, create a canopy, utilize your full light potential. Exactly. You want to essentially, you know, fill that space. You got to think this is all real estate and you're wasting the space that the plant's not in. If it's being lit up and there's no plant in it, it's a waste. So you really want to maximize your size. And Chris Malloy, that package is on the way, my friend. So I definitely am looking forward to you getting your seeds.
So I topped my plant about 3 times in total. But I also scrog my plant and I also super crop my plant. Because you always have like those, you know, when you got 36 tops, you're always going to have those 3 or 4 branches that are just like, you know what, like I'm not going with the flow. You know, and you got a super crop. If you got right. Like, you know, chum with bosses, really stay down there.
Yeah, I mean, and if you absolutely just can't get that to work, you can super crop everything and just smash your plant underneath a scrog. And it should be fine. Honestly, I think people do. I think they do way too much, you know, babying when they jam a plant underneath the scrog net. You should just take 6 to 10 inches off, right off the height. You know,
yeah.
Get the light a good 20 inches away. Let it grow through the scrog. You know.
Clean the lowers up. I see a lot of people that scrog that don't necessarily clean the under canopy up. I mean, you want pretty much nothing under that scrog net, but just, you know, a few leaves that are connected to some of those nodes that, you know, still have developing bud sites, and you don't necessarily want to take away. But everything underneath, once that canopy fills out, there's going to be no light penetration down there anyway. So it's just naturally going to slowly dwindle off, but it's taking, you know, power away from the top of your plant. You know, it's consuming nutrients and vital, you know, micronutrients that could be utilized much better at the top, where, you know, like Eric was talking about, you know, photons, and you have uniform light. All those branches up there usually should be, you know, we call them praying hands. You know, they're usually all like that because they're getting everything that they need. They don't have to fight with other leaves and branches to, you know, get what they need. So everything is uniform. They're getting all the love that they can want and need, you know, and you cut all that lower undergrowth off, you know, to essentially help feed the top. So that's airflow too. I mean, I don't know what kind of pots most people grow in. You know, the standard plastic pot, fabric pot, you know, 5-gallon buckets, basically whatever they have at their disposal. You know, so like if you have multiple plants in there, airflow is also key. You know, that's to help regulate your VPD, which is your temperature to humidity ratio, because VPD is important. I'm sure we'll cover that either later in this episode or the next episode.
Well, hold on. Before you get too far away from where we were a second ago.
I'm still on Scrogger, you know.
What's up, John? What's up, Amanda? How you doing, Mike? So, like you said, defoliation.
Yeah, very important.
Once you get into flower, you should have week 1, 3, 5, you know, defol. But, you know, a good rule of thumb is when you're going into flower, like 1 week beforehand, you want to, I really like the Kyle Cushman technique of going 3 nodes or 5 nodes down and stripping the rest of it. People call it like a semi-lollipop. I like that method, but I think that stretching it out over time has benefits to the plant not being as stretched. as stressed out. Some people say that it's a waste of time. So, you know, check out which way you would do it. But what the basic thing is with the Kyle Kushman one, you take, you go basically every top, right? And you just count 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then you just pinch the branch and you literally strip everything to the bottom. So you're basically left with, like, you know, this little section of canopy at the top. You spread it out. Good to go into flower. You don't do any more trimming in flower. No default. What I like to do is when you look at your plant from wherever it's scrogged and take a picture of your canopy and literally draw a line at 50% of the canopy. And anything that doesn't reach that, any straggler branch that doesn't pass that line, comes right off. It's usually all suckers off the bottom. So all those are gone right away. Then everything that is your top cola down should be, and I go 8. That's what I like to do. I like to count 8 tops down and take everything from 8 tops down on the main colas. And then anything that's inward facing leaf. So if it's facing towards the center of the canopy, just cut it off. It's only going to get bigger, cover more shit. You know what I mean? And anything covering a bud site. These leaves are going to grow back, or it's just going to grow bigger leaves from somewhere else. It's not going to grow the same leaf back, but you know what I mean? You're going to take one away from here. It's just going to grow back somewhere else. So defoliating in the right place at the right time is definitely important. So week one, you do a decent defoliation. You set the thing up. I do this a week before. So before you flip, you'd go, you'd set everything, you'd do your defol. You'd let it sit for a week in the scrog. Everything would start turning upward. Then you'd flip the lights. That's how I usually do it with the scrog. Then you have 2 weeks of your plant going there. People call it pre-flower. I usually only see pre-flower for like a week, a little more than a week, because plants are mature and they're ready and they have very low stress going in. So, you know, then comes around a week 3 and you're just going to move that 25% line up a little bit and up a little bit. And you're going to get to that 50% of the canopy mark. And that should be clean from there down. Being that, you know, when you look through the canopy from the top, you should still be able to see the soil through all the leaves. You know, like Matt was saying, airflow, having good, you know, space and separation for the buds. If their fan leaves are touching each other, they're not going to swell or get any bigger. They have sensories to keep themselves from overgrowing themselves, essentially. So, you know, spreading them out and then defoliating is actually more preferred than defoliating and then spreading them out, because you're going to get a better sense of what you should keep.
Well, but just to briefly touch on why it's super important to defoliate as well, is because when you get into those, you know, flowering weeks, the later weeks, you know, you got these big buds and your plant is just retaining moisture. Like, it's just sucking water up nonstop, because it's producing those big buds and they're, you know, they take a lot of water. So if you got, you know, a heavy canopy or heavy growth in there that, like, everything's all smashed together, you know, what tends to happen when you have moisture, crowded space, you know, and essentially light, you get mold, you get funguses that are not good for your plant. So being able to provide the proper airflow so you don't get, you know, a white powdery mildew or anything from, like, how the humidity is in your tent. And, you know, that's generally why they also tell you to drop the humidity a little bit during flower. But I actually find that a little bit higher humidities work great, but if you have that airflow going through your plant. So you definitely don't want to spend, you know, a couple months vegging a plant out, prepping it, getting it into flower, and then halfway through flower you have, like, all this mildew because you didn't defoliate your plant, you know, properly to what it required you to. Not saying that you will get mold. I mean, you could have a bushy plant and not get it, but I'm just saying it's a strong possibility.
You could live in an area that's so freaking, you know, dry that you could never get mold. You know what I mean? Just Right. Or you could live in a place that no matter what, you're always battling the possibility of mold, even with heavy defoliations.
Yeah. Like you know, you're a basement grower or, you know, I mean, it could happen outside too. It happens outside quite a bit, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very common, like, issue with outdoor grows. Because a lot of people just let their plants rot. You know, they don't do anything
to them. They get massive.
Yeah, they do. They
get massive. Airflow is impossible on a plant that's 7 foot high and 6 feet around, you know?
Like, right, absolutely. I totally get that. But
basically get inside of it to trim it.
You know, the majority of our community are, you know, indoor folks, so I mean, if you're in like a basement, definitely it's a high humidity, high mold probability area, you know, so you definitely want to have the right environment for your plant to thrive and not, because it's easier to just not have those issues. You know, it's a pain to try to correct those and get all that rectified and, you know, tamper with things while your plant's flowering and you're just trying to like get nice, awesome buds of smoke. But here you're on an uphill battle with your plant and it's struggling and it's not producing the way it should. So it, you know, it can, one little thing could throw your whole train off track here.
I just want to ask and answer a question. Mike said either that or bottom lights too. What I've seen for bottom lights versus a different training method. So I've talked about this before, and it's worth bringing it up now, I guess. So most of the methods that are applied are really just compensation for light photon penetration and thermal radiation. So what does that mean in actual English? All these techniques of scrogging and sea of green and, you know, doing heavy defoals and lollipopping and schwazing and the Kyle Cushman technique, all of these things are compensation. That's it. Everybody's compensating for not having the thermal power, the heat throwing, that the HPS and ceramic metal halide does, and it's compensation for the PPFD output and spectrum. So, you know, if you're looking for getting big bottom buds, you know, and you have LED, adding more light isn't necessarily the answer when temperature, CO2, and if you lollipopped a plant and gave it the correct wattage, you know what I mean? It would do the same thing as adding bottom lights. And I don't think that adding bottom lights will give you a better result than running these plants in the correct temperatures and environment for LED. I see everybody doing these things. They're compensating for not having high pressure sodium, right? Or even the inputs of high pressure sodium. So they're going to scrog. But then they don't get their 10 over 70 degrees, you know, or 75. They don't have their humidity and VPD way, way up there when that's where these plants need to be to operate. So realistically, like you're saying, adding a bottom light, right? Would that be necessary if you were to see the way it grew? If you didn't add a bottom light and you got your temperature and humidity and environment CO2 up to where it needed to be for it to actually use those photons that are hitting the bottom of the tent. Because keep in mind, you have a lot of light that is infinitely bouncing around inside of this mylar. You could take the smallest little light and check its photon array at 1 foot and then put it in a tent and then check it at 2 feet, and I bet you that the reading is basically the same. So the reason is because there's reflection in there. So you have photons going everywhere, 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 everywhere. He started with HPS, he said. It makes sense. But like, you know, these photons are going everywhere, and I don't think people give the plants enough processing power, really, you know, in that sense. Like you, your plant needs CO2 to be able to photosynthesize photosynthetically active radiation. So like if you're not going to be having more than ambient CO2, you're not even going to be using, you know what I mean? Like those photons aren't going to be used. This is why people can bleach plants with LED, but not really with high pressure sodium. It's the temperatures. So I think that you're better off getting the temps dialed in and the techniques for LED than adding more LEDs. Because that technique is there because of the fact that the light is just, it's just delivered differently. It's a different light delivery system. You know what I mean? So that's why scrogging is there and you defoliate the bottom, because you'll get more out of the top by taking those away from the bottom completely and making such a thick canopy light could never penetrate through it than it is to have those on the bottom and try to get those little larfy guys to make, be made into buds. LED doesn't travel very far with its heat, and that's really what's the challenge.
Like that's one of the reasons why, like, you don't have to really adjust an HPS, you know, as you do an LED, you know, because HPS is pretty much uniform from where that light sits all the way to the ground with its PPFD thermal radiation. They're very strong, efficient light sources, you know, HPS, ceramic metal halide, whereas LED, to kind of get that kind of thermal radiation, because they don't emit as much as HPS and, you know, ceramic metal halide. So you got to get the light closer to the plant to achieve that, which is why, like, you're raising your light when your plant grows. So you want to kind of try to get as much of that thermal radiation as possible. But I mean, that's, you know, growing LEDs and growing HPS are two different monsters. Both have their pros and cons, you know.
Right. And that's the big thing there, though. You know, like if you had a high pressure sodium light and it's 15 feet above your head and you go stand under it, you will feel it warming you up. You know what I mean? And that's what thermal radiation transfer is. And this is why you get a higher, you know, you get a higher count of like larger buds off of the high pressure sodium grow. The entire time the leaf temp is high. And you, this is, I'll just say it this way. When you keep a high pressure sodium in check, it's at 72 to 75 degrees. That's your tent ambient air temp. And the reason is because you're literally fighting the temp that's coming off of the high pressure sodium. But those leaves are getting beaten with 80, 85 degrees all the time. And what happens when the plant's surface of its leaves gets heated up over 82 degrees, the stomata opens, allowing CO2 uptake to happen. So if you have a tent at 74 degrees ambient temp and it's not running high pressure sodium, there's a really high chance your leaves are 75, 76 degrees. But then when you get closer towards the top leaves, to the top of the canopy, you're going to see the 80s. And this is why these lights work at 12 inches, because at 12 inches, they can heat your plant up and they can heat up a decent amount of your canopy 10, 12 inches into the canopy, because of the fact that these stomata are going to be open all the time. That's not the only thing that opens a stomata. So does plant growth regulators, PGRs open stomatas. There's a lot of things that make this plant uptake CO2. Temperature being the easiest one to manipulate. You know, they say that birds chirping does the exact same thing. I don't know how many birds you have, but it's very easy to get the temp up versus go get birds and have them chirp. You know, you can play sounds of birds chirping while you have the temperatures up. And this is stuff that other people test, you know, knowing that they know these things. But Yeah, Ted Farmer just said it. You can influence stomata opening with recordings of bird songs too. Right. So, you know, if that is worth exploring the birds, then it's worth you having the right ambient temperature. And I think that these things, what we talked about last time is, you know, sticking to the basics. You know, the basics are always going to, you know, lead you the right way. So having the right temperatures, having the right humidity. Matt was saying vapor pressure density, vapor pressure deficit, VPD. That's extremely important. It has a lot more to do with the plant in a sense of like, you know, the plant has water in it and the air has water in it. And when the plant sucks up water out of the soil, it needs to get those nutrients to the different parts of the plant and exhaust the water. So it pushes the water back out the leaves. There's too much water in the air, or the VPD is, I believe it's low. If it's too low and the humidity is too high, the plant can't exhaust water. So it's going to droop and be really sad. And the humidity is too high, and it's obvious those things because it's like everything's wet. Yeah, makes sense. Now, the other way is that the VPD goes the other way, and now the air is too dry. So you're going to water your plant and your leaves are going to be up in the air. It's going to look like, you know, everything's going to kind of look a little bit weird. And that, I don't know if you've ever seen that on a seedling, but the leaves just stick up in the air. That's because the humidity is too low and the water in the plant is getting literally just sucked out by the air all the time. So this is why you have to balance VPD so that when your plant wants to exhaust, it can exhaust. Because when it can't do anything but exhaust because it's getting sucked out of it, it only can suck up water. And when it runs out of water, this is where people run into issues and stunting their plant a little bit every other day or whatever. Environment's really important, you know, especially to consistent growth and flower. You know, you were saying running your humidity a bit higher is a risk. It's only a risk if your VPD is off. You know, you could have a plant at 100 degrees. Do you know the VPD for 100 degrees, Matt?
It's 85% humidity.
Yeah, it's like 90. 90% humidity. But you got to think about it. It's 100 degrees, and that pot has any water in it. It's going to be in the air before that plant even has any water left. Like, it's just going to go from the pot through the plant into the air because it's so dry. You know, and this is why plants can't live in the desert. You know, I mean, like a lot of
my general rule of thumb is if your temperature is a certain number, your humidity should be 5 to 7 points under that.
Yeah. If you go look up how the VPD chart breaks down in actual factors of numbers, you can figure that out. But it changes as soon as you get into flower. It's the same numbers, but it's a different selection. And if you look at the VPD chart, and I suggest everybody who's growing, print one out for veg and flower and post it. Just put it on the wall. You know what I mean? Just stick it up there because it's going to help you infinitely to look at that and go, oh, I'm at 70 degrees. I need 44% humidity. And that's in veg. But then if you get into flower, that's different. You know, then that would change. But in flower, you should be like 85 and 60. 85 degrees, 60% humidity.
Yeah, I usually, like, during veg, I usually run like 84. And my humidity would be somewhere in between 72 and 75, which is a pretty good VPD. Flower, I usually run it at, you know, pretty much the same temp. But I drop it to like 62 to 66.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you have a plan, you should be good, you know, and it's about consistency. That's where it being a weed comes in. So like, you don't really need this thing to have perfect VPD all the time. It does really help when you're trying to get the best quality out of it, obviously. But, you know, if you're like, hey, man, I can't get this to 1.1. I'm trying to get to 1.1 VPD. I can only get to 1.2. If you can maintain it, your plant is healthy, happy, you don't have any issues, you got good airflow, shouldn't have any problem with your grows. You know, it's more or less not knowing and then thinking everything's good and then screwing everything up in the meantime. You know, that's the problem. And you don't even want to get into whether you're going to smoke moldy weed or not. But yeah, it's good to just avoid all that by following the right practices.
Little baby dab.
Yeah, you know what it's funny is I packed a bowl of snow caps and super booth before.
And you haven't smoked any of it yet?
No, I smoked that entire bowl and I couldn't couldn't realize, like,
I wasn't paying attention. I smoked all the weed.
Dude, it didn't occur to me why I was literally dying trying to smoke that, but makes sense now because, yeah, half booth, half snow caps. This is full booth.
They're called booth caps.
Super booth. I love that it's backwards.
Any questions from the chat? Anything you guys want to talk about, know about? While we're kind of like bringing this episode to its close here.
You know what's funny, Matt, is we've been on for 55 minutes. Yeah. But we didn't have sound until 31 minutes ago.
Shit happens.
So, we've only actually been on for 32 minutes.
Okay.
But anyway, so...
Well, if anybody has any questions now, I mean, they can ask questions. We can talk.
We got William McFerrin said, great info. Makes a lot of sense. And then Ted Farmer said, appreciate the info regarding VPD.
Yeah.
So...
Well, another thing too, like with VPD, you know, since we're on the subject, you know, if you grow with CO2 supplements, either, you know, like a grow bag or, you know, if you actually have like a CO2 canister system, VPD is super important, you know, with the whole stomata thing. Like, not only does the temperature have to be right, the leaf temperature, but you know that humidity has to be in check as well for it. You know, it'll open regardless, but if you have like the very precise humidity that plant requires, it's gonna like fully, like full throttle open and be able to absorb way more CO2. That's gonna boost your growth. You know, it's just going to put more energy into your plant, you know, and it also helps, you know, that plant expel other things that it doesn't need during that process as well. Think of plants like your hands or your feet, like they have lots and lots of little micro pores. So what happens when like your skin gets dry and leathery, it doesn't breathe that great. You know, it's not moisturizing. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. You know, too soft, you're always soggy or clammy. So like that perfect area where your hands are, you know, not moist, not too moist, they're able to properly breathe and push toxins out of your body, you know, get excess water out of your body. So, I mean, it's the same for a plant. So if your humidity is not in check, if it's too low, your leaves are naturally going to start to dry out, you know, because of what Eric's saying. The air is actually sucking water from your plant, which is why when we finish bud and we're hanging it, we hang it in the open air because we know that as that air comes through, it's going to pull that moisture slowly out of the plant.
Right.
you know, but again, if it's too high, you know, now your plant's like, think of it as like you put your foot in a sock and your sock in a shoe and you start
No, not even that.
curl.
Not even that,
Yeah,
dude. You
you
know,
got
like it's
soggy sock syndrome, dude.
you're in the summertime when it's so hot you can't take anything else off. Like you could not sweat enough to cool your body down. That's because there's more humidity in the air than in your body. So for your body to push the water out, the VPD is happening with you as well.
And you
Like
just sweat
if it's a
constantly.
right, if it was 90% humidity all the time, your body wouldn't be able to sweat correctly. You'd eventually fucking literally not be able to hydrate yourself. Like you'd just have problems. Like, you know what I mean? And the other way, going the other way, if you were in 10% humidity, they would issue a state of emergency. You could just die just being there. Like literally, it would just
I mean,
suck the water out of you. It would literally dehydrate you to the point where you would look like a decrepit ass, dried out plant.
yeah, I mean,
100%.
I'm gonna get a little philosophical here, you know.
But that is VPD, the water transpiration between, you know, what is the
Airplane.
philosphere of the plant? No, the skin. It's literally the
Yeah, the skin.
pores of the plant. It's getting sucked dry by the air being too dry.
I mean, plants are very much like human beings, you know, like we eat constantly, pretty much, you know, like we eat multiple times a day, every single day. You know, we require water, you know, we require essential vitamins and minerals, you know, to have I don't want to say a super healthy body, but you know, a functioning, produce energy producing body so that we can get out and do what we're supposed to do on a daily basis. You know, if we're very dehydrated, you know, what happens? We get headaches, you know, we feel sluggish, we have a loss of energy, which leads to not us producing the way we normally would, or not at the rate that we normally would produce. You know, if you have too much of these things, like what you eat too much, what happens? You're just like, oh, you're bogged down. You know, you don't want to, you know,
You're
do
burnt.
anything. You're
You're
right.
burned
You're
out.
essentially like your body is so focused on digesting and trying to burn this off that it's not putting the energy into the rest of your body where it needs to be. You know, so plants are a lot like that. If you give them, you know, the right food, the right meals, you know, they're getting the necessary water. And again, with water, like you can drink too little and not really feel hydrated, but you can drink too much to the point where like you're overhydrated and like your stomach's just full of water and you just don't feel that great. You know, those are what plants go through and feel the same things we do. So it's important to learn your plant, learn where it's at and what stage you're in, how it's consuming things. That's why like grow journaling is super cool, and it's also super important because it helps you identify and it helps you form a plan as you're growing, you know, because you know, like, okay, week one, my plant's only consuming 6 ounces of water every 2 days, you know, in this size planter. And then you go up and you transplant because it's getting bigger now. And then you kind of just you write it down, you know, and you see what your plant's telling you. It's called reading your plant and listening to your plant, you know. So if you go into a 3 gallon pot and you water with 24 ounces of water and your plant starts to droop, that's your plant saying, hey man, like chill
Too
out on the
much.
water. You know, now that instead of it absorbing all that water within 2 days, now it's sitting for 3 or 4 days. You know, that's like your plant saying, hey, that's too much at once. Like, give me, wait till I get a little bit bigger. You know, so you bring your next watering down. Okay, well, it took 4 days. Let me cut that in half. Let me try 12. You know, and then your plant might react well to that. And then as it grows, it's going to droop or it's going to droop a lot faster and dry out a lot faster. That's when you can start increasing. You know, I like to do increments of, you know, 8 ounces, because it's not too much if I overwater. It's not too little if I underwater. I mean, 8 ounces is a cup of water. And you just, you journal that. So like taking information down is very necessary almost, you know, to the point where, and you can use it for future growth. So you're not guessing the next time, you know, like I said, every plant grows different. Everything is different on each plant. But it gives you a really good baseline, a starting line, you know, like your go-to. And if you have to alter things along the way with that plant, journaling is also important, because if you try to follow the same method before that worked well for the plant previous, it might not work as well for the next plant.
Right.
You know.
We got Mark Schmuck. Did you already say the optimal range? Optimal range in veg that I run is like 70, 75, about 45 to 50% humidity. And then in flower, around 82 to 85, 60, 65% humidity. And then Mike said, what's the best CO2 generator? You might not like my answer, but the best is just having a controller. You know, bite the bullet, pay for automation. It's just going to do you better in the long run. Especially if you worked with something like we design, where our light controller is actually an environment controller, and it can dim the lights, let the heat get up, dim the fans. Well, not dim the fans, but turn the fans all the way down, dim the lights to, you know, 30% under what they are, and really flood that tent with CO2 to what you want. And then as that comes down naturally, it would kick everything back up. So essentially, I like controlling with a tank. I like flooding, doing controlled floods with tanks. I don't really like the whole running a consistent, constant 1,500 PPM the entire time. I think if you flood for an hour a day, or even twice a day for an hour, while shutting off circulating fans and really just kind of hotboxing that tent with CO2 for your plants, even maybe playing some bird song recordings in that same period, but, you know, really just allowing your plants to uptake as much CO2 as possible with the highest temperatures that your tent can get to without damaging your plant. You don't want to really nuke them with the light temperature when you could bring the fans down and just let it naturally get to that temp for an hour around 85 or more, and just throw a ton of CO2 in there.
Well, let's kind of like stay where you're at, but before we get too deep into that, hold that thought for real, because we're going in a good direction. But tent pressure, really quick, like air exchange is super important as well, especially when you're growing with CO2. So if you see like your tent walls are like sucked in because your exhaust fan is overpowering your inline fan, you're essentially like just the air is exchanging at such a high rate that it's sucking everything out of your tent. So like when Eric's talking about is flooding and, you know, reducing your fan speed in the tent, you want to see your walls kind of expand out like someone's blowing up a balloon. That's meaning that, you know, the air is staying within your tent. It's circulating, allowing that plant to absorb what it wants and needs to absorb, instead of just like, you know, it's like dangling a carrot in front of your plant. If it's too high and your walls are sucked in, your plant's like, let me get that. No, you can't have it. Right. As far, and the opposite of that is blowing your tent. So
there's two ways though. If you were to do negative pressure CO2 flooding, you would want to mount your tank hoses. You'd want to mount your emitters low. This way that they get ran into the plant. The CO2 gets just like, you know, it has to collide with the bottoms of the leaves on the way out. And this is why it's important you shut your circulating fans off so that you get a natural gas rise. You blow that around, and believe it or not, you're expending the CO2 while you're blowing it around in the air. It's like pouring salt into water. If you're mixing it and you pour it in, it's going to dissolve immediately. If you just pour it straight in, still water, you can see it all drop and collect in one spot, right? So this is the same kind of thing. When you have gases mixing, it's like liquid mixing. It dilutes into the air instantaneously. So it's better to have your circulating fans off. It's better to have your intake fans off, or at least on low. But what Matt's talking about is positive pressure. Positive pressure means you're putting more environment in than what's coming out. Most people run negative, which means more environment's coming out than going in. And what he's saying is you're allowing all of that environment to escape. When you have the correct size fans, you can achieve positive pressure and the correct amount of air exchange for the size tent and space. But what you do is you end up retaining more heat and you end up retaining more environment. So when you do run CO2, you can hang on to it for longer instead of just dumping out the window. It's like driving with the heat on and your window completely open. You know, it's, you're not going to see 90% of that heat. You might see some of it on the way out, but a lot of it's going, you know. John said, I'd like to stay around 5% water to soil volume. And I've actually seen a lot of people have really good results with 5 to 7% of the pot size, essentially. So if you're doing, you know, a 1 gallon, you'd just be able to do the conversion pretty easily. I don't actually know what those conversions are because I just kind of water, you know. I don't know. I have a knack for it, I guess. I was always the kid that my mom handed the watering can to and water everything, and then she'd yell at me, you know, the whole time I was screwing it up. So I feel like I know how much water to give a plant based on its size.
Yeah.
You know, like I just know that. But
what is there? There's 16 cups of water in a gallon, right?
Well, if you did it by cups,
16.
There, you could do it by ounces as well, but.
Well, gallons, 128 fluid ounces. Divided by 8 ounces in a cup. I believe that equates to 16 cups, if I'm not mistaken.
Like I said, I did have never done the math. John, if you've done the math, what's the actual math on it? Because I'm not even going to try to do it, let alone Matt. He's trying to freaking...
I mean, I just ranged
it. He's trying to beautiful mind this real quick in his head.
There's 16 cups of water in a gallon.
Okay, so...
There's 8 cups and a half gallon. 8 times 8 is 64. And then you double that, you get 128, so it would be 16 cups. My math is mathing, bud.
Okay, so 16 cups.
Right, so 5% of that for a 1 gallon. That's what you would do.
Exactly. So that's what I was saying. 16 times 5% is 0.8.
Yeah. So a cup of water. Which is pretty accurate. Yeah. I would say that's fairly accurate. Although I don't measure water. I just water my plant to weight. So... But it also depends on how.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Some people water until they get runoff so that they can test it. You know, it all depends on what kind of pots you're using. You know, fabric pots tend to dry out a lot quicker. Personally, I use an Autopot system. I use an Autopot system with an air dome, like hydrogen at the bottom, 1.5, 2 inches. So my plant is constantly has water, but it only uptakes what it wants. So the plant dictates when it's drinking, when it's not drinking. There's a float system with that. So, I mean, you know, like
he said one cup for his 1 gallon, his plant would be drooping in 2 hours.
Well, that's 5% of the world volume.
I think you took the piss on that one. John, if you're still here, how much would you give your 5 gallon? Is it 5 cups? I feel like a 5 gallon is 2 cups, 3 cups.
No, dude. 5 gallon is like...
It's every couple days.
A gallon of water.
It's every couple days.
Yeah, but a 5 gallon, I'm pouring almost a gallon of water into that thing.
And what life cycle? Veg? Because in flower, I think you move to 10. Which would be 5 to 1, right? 5 gallon. Or that'd be a half.
5% of 10 would be a half a gallon. That can't be right.
It'd be 10%.
Yeah.
Of 5 gallons.
Well, then it would be, yeah. It'd be
half a gallon.
If you got a big plant, I mean, dude.
I don't know why people introduce math to stoners. This makes no sense that people would just put you at, like, you know, hey, you're a stoner that's going to do math regularly now.
That's why, like, I've never really actually.
That's what I mean. This is why I said I wasn't getting into doing this. I knew I wouldn't even be able to.
I measure my water. I measure my water in the early stages, but like once I transplant that thing into like, if I'm in like a 3 gallon and up, I water to weight by then because I don't know. I just let the plant, and every 2 days, like I'll wait, you know, and I'll pick the plant up and see if it's light. If it's light, then I water. If it still feel like. And you have soil meters, you can kind of...
It's less than a cup, dude.
Yeah.
It's less than a cup per gallon.
We can't do that.
So in a 5 gallon, he said, in a 10 gallon, it'd be half a gallon.
I mean, dude, if you see results that way, I mean, you know, I'm not one to say it's not the right way to do it. I mean, I'm just...
Sharpies on clear containers. Mike said, I guess I try to keep it simple. I use Sharpies on clear containers. I have marks for the different size pots I use. Figured it out with time and practice. Right. I don't need, like, me trying to figure this out mathematically would probably just yield the same thing that I would do regularly. So, yeah, I would give a gallon pot plant a cup of water, yes. That makes sense. But it's actually less. It's like 6.5 ounces.
I mean, yeah, I guess that's kind of accurate. I mean,
and then when you get into flower, you would be giving it 2. And yeah, that's accurate too, but you just got to give it to it slow. And it's going to like take up the whole first one if it's thirsty.
I mean, but if you have a massive plant though, dude, like.
Yeah, if you have a massive plant.
It's going to drink way more. Like, I mean, I guess you could just give it 2 cups of water at a time. It'd probably be like every day, though.
I think this is like every 2 days you'd be feeding it.
I don't know, dude. I grow some monsters. So,
I mean, but you're not going to really have runoff.
Exactly. Well, that's like another thing. Like, people that test their runoff to see, like, you know, how their soil is doing and how much to feed. And
John said he feeds every 3 days in veg and every other day in flower. That's how I used to do it too. 2 days, 3 days. I used to do 3 days in flower just because, like, making plants that I would had going. I fucking make 4 gallons every 2 days. I'd lose my mind.
Yeah, I mean, plant. That's why I switched to the auto pot. So I just put the water in the reservoir and, you know, off to the races she goes.
Oh, yeah. She used 12 gallons a week. You didn't even know. You're like, holy shit, it's empty.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that thing, I'll fill that thing up like 3/4 of the way. I'll put like 8 gallons in that bitch. And fuck, dude. Like 5-6 days, it's gone. That's what I'm saying. Like, and that's just the plant, like, doing its, like, that's what the plant wants. You know, if I had a very small plant and I put that reservoir up, it would stay full for 2-3 weeks.
I can't hear somebody say it's what any, like, if you put it's what plants and want, like, in any sense, if that's in a sentence, I just immediately think of Brando and Idiocracy. Like, there's just no other way about it. It's what they want. The electrolytes. It's Brando. It's what plants want.
Well, like I said, I'm not saying, you know, that way is incorrect what someone else is doing. I mean, if they're getting the value of
that. Mark asked, how do you keep your autopot pH straight? Does it just stay put? You would keep your pH correct by pHing your reservoir. And you're going to pH your tank like it's a hydro or coco run. So you want it to stay like 5.8.
I,
5.5, 5.8.
I actually have like a 5-gallon like water jug that I fill up. Throw an Airstone in it. I let it do that for 24 hours. I will pH my water. And it usually sits for another like 12 hours. And then I put it in the res. Now, I used to use Airstones in those autopot reservoirs. When I found out that actually raises the pH over the course of 2 to 3 days, I would see the pH rise by like 4 to 5 points.
Do you know why? What does pH mean? Do you know what pH means?
No.
Great. I get to teach you too. pH means probability of hydrogen.
Right.
So if you're adding air
to the water, it's putting more molecules into the water. You know, Eric's going to get scientific with it. I'm not that guy. so even though I guess my nickname's the doctor. I took the Airstones out because like initially I was afraid. I was like, oh, I better put an Airstone in there so like I don't get algae or any type of bacteria that's unwanted. But then when I saw how fast these plants were consuming water, I was just like, oh shit, I don't even need to do that. So once I took the Airstone out, I noticed that it had a more stable pH. So the way I do it is I know it takes about 5 days for it to go through the amount of water that I put in there. So like I'll test it initially right before I put it in. And then 2 to 3 days in, if there's, you know, half a res left, I'll test it again, see where it's sitting at, if it came up a little bit or if it went down a little bit. And then I just, you know, get the dropper out and boop, boop, boop. Directly into the reservoir. I got this wooden cooking spoon because I'm getting
I got a yardstick.
Right. And I mix it up, you know, and I just let it, and then I'll wait, you know, 15 minutes. I'll test again, see where it's at. If it's back in line, then I know I don't have to do anything with it further. But also, like, I recognize that. So, like, that now that's in my brain, you know, I don't really write it down, but if I consistently achieve the same thing, hey, if I put this water in at 5.8 and in 2 days it's at, you know, 6.4 and I need to put, you know, 4 drops of pH down in that bitch to get it back to where it was, you know, and it happens consistently after the first couple of weeks, then I just know that that's what I have to do, you know? So like, I don't have to waste time throwing a pH meter in there and testing it and doing all this. I just know because that's what's naturally going to happen in my environment. So I just, you know, keep it in my brain. Like, okay, I filled this on Monday. I need to come back on Wednesday, put 4 drops of pH down in, mix it up really good. And I don't have to do shit until, you know, the next time I fill the reservoir. So it's pretty simple. And like, you know, if you guys are like me and I have a hectic life, you know, those things are like a godsend almost, because like there's some days where like I wouldn't get home to check on my plants that day, or I'd be so tired, like I would just fucking not come up here, you know.
Automation's a beautiful thing, bro.
Right. So now, like, if I skip a day, or if I go out of town for an event, let's say over the weekend, you know, for Great Green Door, like, I don't have to sit here and stress, or, you know, call my buddies and be like, hey, man, do you think you can go over Saturday and, like, check all my plants, see if it needs water, so when I come back, it's not a half dead. You know, like, I don't need to do that anymore. So it's very, you know, easy. And plants have been nothing but monsters growing in those things, you know, because it's like it's impossible to over and underwater. So like that plant is just like living its best life, and I get bangers out of them every time. Like if you guys know my Instagram, like I'm wall to wall one plant and 4x4s and 3x3s. And, you know, those critical 47 autos that I grew in there got freaking 4.5 feet tall indoor. And they were, dude, 2 plants took up a 4x4, like smacked in there. like just monsters. And like, I'm not saying like you can't achieve those things with regular pots and all, like, you can, you know, just for me and my time management, that's, you know, I use light timers. Everything's pretty much on a timer. I have apps on my phone where, like, I could check this shit from work. You know, I get alerts real time. And, like, we have a lot of that equipment, you know, in our shop. But, like, it's just, it's so easy, man. Because, like, you can just literally, you only have to go into your grow space, like, only weekly, really, if you want. You know, I mean, always check on your plants, but like essentially you can be gone for a week and your plant would be just fine. It would be like you're there with it 24/7 because it's everything is automated. It, you know, so that's like a really great thing, especially like if you have multiple grow stations, like most of us do, you know, like I have 3 units that I could like have to manage, you know, and that's not an easy task when you're, you know, putting in 45 hours a week at a job and you got kids and you got events to go to, and like, you know, it can get a little crazy sometimes.
Just make sure you follow the Coco Hydro pH, because that's what Autopot doesn't put explicitly right on the cover, but should say it right on the pot, because you're putting soil in there and then you're watering it right with, you know, if you go with the soil parameters, even if you're in the higher range, you're screwing it up. So really you should be watering that beforehand with like a 5.8 so that when you get into the pot, turning it on, you know, you're at better chance of not shocking your plant.
Right. Because your soil has natural pH buffers in it, so it's always going to bring it to, like, you know, anywhere in between 6 and 7, depending on what medium and brand you're using.
Right, but in veg, you really want it, like, 6.0 or a little bit below, I mean, anyway.
Even if you're putting 5, you know, with Autopots, you're putting 5.8 in, it's really probably coming out somewhere around 6.2, 6.3. Because of the pH buffers. So, I mean,
I'm trying to figure out whether you should just bottom feed an Autopot right off the start. You know, I know that they say not to, but you really, when you have this medium, right, that you're watering, you're going to water and all stuff's going to try to travel down, and then you're going to put in the pot, it's going to all travel back up. So you're going to have your buildups all on the top. So it's like, it's almost like it makes more sense to not top feed it at all.
Yeah, I mean, I started off top feeding only because, like, I want the roots to figure out, like, hey, this is the way you, this is the way you got to go.
Right, but if you bottom fed, the bottom 2 inches would have.
Well, I do actually put water in the bottom as well because I want that soil to kind of like almost fully saturate, or I don't want certain parts of my soil to be hydrophobic, meaning they've been dried out for so long that they take some of, they actually repel water, you know. So I'll bottom water so that a lot of that moisture can get distributed into the soil completely, which also activates your soil. You know, it's given that soil, you know, a few days, doesn't have roots in it, you know, it can kind of inoculate itself, you know, those organisms can start coming to life and building that, you know, soil food web, and, you know, the chain reactions that happen in living soil to start to develop and occur. So that way, when your plant starts to root in those areas, you know, all those exchanges are happening, and it just gives a great root environment for your plant.
And there's actually a lot to unpack there that we'll probably talk about another time. But what a lot of soil companies do too, and it's a simple fact that they want to save money on shipping, is they do something called solarizing their soil. So they will dry it out and bring what's called the soil, it's called the hydroscopic biome, I think. So that's how much water film is in the soil that the microbial life can live off of. And what they do is they essentially dehydrate the soil to a point that that film level is almost nothing. So you get it, and there's not a huge boom of life in it until you put water back into it, and it has some time to establish these microorganism colonies again that were living in there before they dehydrated it. So really all these things need is water. Especially if you have something with mycorrhiza in it, in the soil already, that's also good to have, you know, establishing before there is a plant running through it and it gets hydrophobic and those pockets in there dry out and essentially those microorganisms die.
Yeah, I actually wet my soil about a week before transplanting. Just so I can kind of get all that stuff started and ready to go. And then when I'm transplanting, you know, it's just like root inoculation and how it attaches on to different things is super important to your plant growth. So like, you know, when you transplant, those roots start spreading to, you know, the outer portions of this new container. It's not just like going through the dirt. No, it's like finding all these little, you know, friends along the way, and they're all big happy family, you know, lollipop guild following the yellow brick road. you know, it just, it gives it a great, I mean, I think of it like coming home to a bunch of friends and family, you know, you get a warm welcome home, you know, hey, come on in, you know, let's eat, let's do all this stuff, let's play games. Instead of just walking down a dark street with nothing going on, you're kind of like, oh shit, I just want to get through this shit.
You know, that's why I actually like pumice over perlite. The pumice actually is porous, but it doesn't break down. Perlite breaks down. Like, you could literally take perlite in your fingers and roll it into dust. But not pumice. Pumice is hard. It's so hard. It's actually what they make those feet cleaning stones and shit out of is pumice. So when you put pumice in the soil, it adds just the same amount of aeration as perlite, except on top of that, since it doesn't break down and it's so rigid, what happens is microorganisms actually install themselves into this like coral reef style cave system in these rocks, right? And then there's like colonies within the pumice because it's a perfect environment. It holds, retains water and all that stuff. And when the roots encounter it, the roots actually can grow into the pumice. So when they grow into the pumice, they grow right into these microorganisms, you know, hives, as to say, and they get even more of an exchange than they would if they were spread out in the soil. And that's because the pumice is such a high water retaining area for these things to get into, and is very porous. And the same thing with mycorrhiza. Mycorrhiza is not just like a mold that's there. It is a system that actually pierces into the roots. So like if you could imagine like hairs coming out of the mycorrhiza going through the actual root itself and making a connection. The mycorrhiza takes stuff from the soil, you know, nutrients, and it wants sugars in return from the plant. So the plant is actually trading on this live connection. And if the plant were to run out of sugars for some reason, the mycorrhiza could not trade. It could just be like, no, you don't have what we bargained for. I'm not giving you nutrients.
Barter system.
And give it to a different plant, let's say. If this was a system in the ground and there were multiple plants hooked to this mycorrhiza system, the mycorrhiza could actually starve a plant out and, you know, assist it in its death by not helping it anymore, and helping another plant that's willing to trade sugars. So when you look at like the biggest formation of mycorrhiza, it's called the Wood Wide Web. And it's literally like this large, humongo stock exchange of nutrients and sugars. And it's like, I think 2000 acres or something like that, that all these trees are connected by. It's like the largest in the world, but they say that it literally is like a stock exchange, and they can take a video of electrical impulses going through all these different parts of the mycorrhiza and the roots, and they can see things channeling back and forth, and they can actually see stuff being loaded up and waiting right at like a trading node, but not being traded. And then you see like, you know, all these pieces come in, and then all of a sudden this whole thing gets unloaded out. So you could literally just watch like the mycorrhiza is just like waiting and watching its bank account go up. And it's just like, not yet, not yet, not yet. And then it's just like, ding. It's like, all right, we can give them what they paid for it now, you know? It's kind of cool. They watch it with the electrical scope. You can see the little electrical movements of everything going through there.
Yeah.
Pretty wild. Pretty wild. But to bring it back to the first comment, you said that plants need to eat just like we do. We're a lot like plants. It's kind of funny, people, we could end on this note, but it's kind of funny that people, you know, are so into farming and growing plants so that, you know, we can live. So, like, we're farming the plants, you know, for us. Realistically, these plants are growing food for us to live, and when you die, plants eat you. So realistically, like, you know, we think we're in control, but these plants are all farming us anyway for their future generations to have something to eat, which is kind of crazy that we think we have it the other way, and then it ends up being symbiotic.
This is true.
Right? So we need them to live. They need us to plant them so that they can eat us later. So
they need us in other ways, you know.
But yeah.
Maybe sure. I'll do the next episode, What Plants Need.
What Plants Need. We'll just get a big Brondo background with a big X on it.
Well, I appreciate everyone for stopping by for this week's little episode. And hope you guys got some good information. Any questions or anything? I mean, you can always reach out to us.
Yep. If you got an idea for next week's episode or something you want us to discuss, definitely look out for our comment section on Facebook, because we're going to ask, what do you want to see in the next podcast? And give us your thoughts. For now, we're going to sign out on EP2. Thanks for sticking with us through the confusion in the first half of this episode, or third. Yeah. No sound. You guys are veterans for sticking with us. Thank you.
And hey, we'd all been there, right?
We'll definitely catch you next week with no issues. And that's us signing out. Have a good night, everyone. Bye. Well, yeah.